This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Taimur Sumro read his story, Philosophy of the Foot, from the January 7th, 2019 issue of the magazine. Sumro is a British-Pakistani writer who's currently a doctoral student at the University of East Anglia. Now here's Taimur Sumro.
Philosophy of the Foot. Between Irem's beauty spot and Primetime Bakery, below a tall palm, a makeshift stall has appeared. It's constructed from coarsely woven white plastic sheeting with Save the Children and a Jumping Jack printed on it in red. A boy, perhaps in his late teens, is sitting on an upturned crate in front of it with a shoe heel up in his lap. "It's a dying art," Armour says to him, slamming and then re-slamming the door of his battered Civic behind him. "It's the glue," the boy says. He wipes the excess from the welt of the shoe with a grubby, balled-up cloth. "With the right one, you're set. None of this Yoo-hoo super glue. The one like paste, like flour and water." The midday sun catches his eyelashes and the thick edge of his nose. He presses his fingers against the sole of the shoe and his nails flush white. The electricity cables overhead are slack and swaying. An electrician is perched in the crook of the tree where the branches meet the trunk, holding a cable with one hand and balancing himself with the other. A rickshaw throttles past Armour. A man parks his sugarcane cart in the shade of a flowering jacaranda tree. He switches on the rattling motor of his juicer and sharpens a giant blade against a stone. Armour's mother's voice cuts through the clamour. Above him, he sees her wheelchair reverse from their balcony into the apartment. The sea air has filigreed the railings with rust. Upstairs, Armour finds her sitting in the dark, the ire fanning her with a folded newspaper. "Small mercies," she says. "What happened today?" "They're making offices," Armour says, "where our house is." She gives a little shriek, like air squeaking from a balloon. "At the end of the month," Armour says. "Let's not talk about it again. There's a shoeboy downstairs. Do you have anything for him?" "I saw you talking from the balcony," his mother says. "Dirty looking." She smooths the fabric of her housecoat against her lap. The ayah follows him out of the room and taps him on the elbow. "There was a trunk of your father's shoes," she says. "That boy could have sold them." Armour takes an old pair of shoes to be repaired. One has a hole in the sole. "The foot is the noblest part of the body," the boy says. He slips a hand inside the shoe. "It is the body's beast of burden. It is the foot soldier for the body's army. 200 rupees at Maghrib." An electricity cable swishes alongside a pole, fuzzy at the end like an elephant's tail. Armour returns to the apartment. What was in the plot opposite their block has been demolished. A pit has been dug and girders and pillars stacked. A mosque has appeared on the far corner of the plot with a minaret so tall and narrow it should topple. The shadows of tree branches lengthen across the ceiling of his bedroom. He hears the azan as though the muezzin were at the foot of his bed. He goes down to collect the shoes. The boy asks him to sit. He rolls a steel canister along its fine edge to Armour. Armour tries the shoes on. The boy watches him wedge his heel in with a finger. "You have wide, flat feet," he says. "Not graceful, but dependable." He directs Armour to walk. and Amr strides to a Suzuki pickup parked a short distance away and back. "I have some shoes of my father's," Amr says. "Maybe you can sell them." "I don't sell shoes," the boy says. "But bring them." Upstairs, his mother and the ayah are arguing over his mother's handbag. Each holds one side, and it gapes between them. "There was," his mother says. "I know there was." A bulb in a lamp on a side table flickers and fizzes. "There wasn't," the ayah says. "I bought butter and flour and dal. What did I buy that with?" "And you've broken every cup," his mother says, letting go of the bag. She grabs a cup from the table and shakes it at the ayah. "Bring me the set. There are 52 pieces. I want to see every one." "We should put something up," Amr says. There are dark squares on the wall where pictures used to hang. "It doesn't look nice." "They're tearing down the old house," his mother tells the ayah. "Have you heard? That bastard, his brother. They allowed us nothing of his. To come and take the pictures, as though we were thieves, and now the house." She covers her eyes with crooked fingers. Amr thinks of his father, delighted but never happy. He thinks of the chowkidar's son, bursting through the back door of the house, shouting, "He's fallen! He's fallen like a bird in the street!" From the balcony, Amr can see the boy packing up his stall. He unpins the sheeting from four metal rods, which are splayed against uneven paving stones, and folds it into a suitcase, along with several plastic bags of shoes. He ducks into the doorway of their building with the crate he sits on, and then again with the steel canister he offered to Amr. With the case balanced on his shoulder, the boy walks down the darkening street in the direction of Clifton. Amr imagines him tending goats on a green hillside. "We offered to send him to the best schools," his mother tells the ayah, nodding toward Amr. "Oxford, Cambridge." "People were begging their parents to go, but he wouldn't. He wanted to stay." "We were happy, of course. But now he could be making millions." She fishes a dirty 100-rupee note out of a pocket of her handbag and gives it triumphantly to the ayah. Amr finds a pair of alligator Gucci loafers that were his father's at the back of his mother's cupboard, with an empty bottle of Monsieur de Givenchy slotted inside one, and a razor with a bone handle in the other. He takes the shoes to the boy in the morning. Someone has tied the loose electricity cable to the pole with a thick red cloth. "Good quality," the boy says. He turns one shoe in his hands, sniffs inside it. "Foreign. Maybe China." He brings the steel canister for Amr to sit on. "I can't sell them," the boy says. They order tea from the cellar up the road. A family on a motorbike swerves to avoid an SUV coming the wrong way. Two beggar children kick an empty plastic bottle back and forth. The sugarcane seller sings, "Her body is like a perfumed song," as he hacks long stalks of sugarcane in half and then in quarters. "Her body is a marble statue." The boy strokes the length of the shoe. "Narrow," he says. "A precise man." He turns it over. The sole has worn a little in the center. "Even," he says. "Show me." He points at Amr's shoe, and Amr takes it off. The boy runs his finger along the edge of the sole. "Worn on the sides, because you're uncertain." He shows Amr the wear on his father's shoe again. "He knows what he wants. His foot is like this." He arches his hand. "Yours He flattens the hand. He stood very straight, Armour agrees, and stands up to demonstrate. Very, he pushes his shoulders back. Impressive. He sits down again. The boy turns to the sheeting of the stall behind him, where he has pinned up a page torn out of a magazine. It shows a marble foot on a plinth, jagged where the leg should continue. The most beautiful, he says to Armour, and traces the foot's arch. Armour leans in and their knees touch. His head dips toward the boy's. He smells hay and frying oil and dark corners. How funny, the boy says. I don't like shoes. In the village, I was barefoot. The foot should be free. Their tea arrives clattering on a tray. Armour asks him about his village. There was fighting, the boy says, blowing hard across the cup, wrinkling the tan skin that has formed on the surface of the tea. And they moved us to a camp. An uncle called me here and gave me this. He waves at the stall behind him. First in Gizri, then phase 5, now here. Armour leaves his father's shoes with the boy. The boy shrugs. I'll polish them up, he says. His mother is watching reruns of last night's Turkish soap. You used to read, he says. Read? I can barely see. She turns up the volume. How tall was Dad? He asks. Ha! She shouts over the TV. He was so much older, but we were head to head. She taps her forehead with her knuckle. If I was in heels, I had to keep sitting. There was a trunk of Dad's stuff, Armour says, with his shoes and things. What do you want with that? She asks. I just want to know where it is, he says. You don't see anyone, she says. I'm too tired. He pauses at the window, and the smell of jasmine and cigarettes winds in from the street below. He pulls the shutters closed. It's always the same talk. Old times. What about new times? What about the next 40 years? I'd rather throw myself out of the window than think about what happened. And from here it wouldn't fix a thing. I'd only break a leg. Both, at best. What are you saying? His mother says. She mutes the volume on the TV. I thought of that friend of yours. Why? What they did to him. Strangled him with the telephone wire. Dirty things he was up to. Picking up boys from the street. Pimping them to who? People we know, probably. Sheikh Assad? He wasn't doing that, Armour says. I hardly knew him. Are you eating? She says. There's packet soup and kebabs on the tray. He finds the ayah napping on the kitchen floor. He asks her about the trunk. She sits up and straightens her sari. I saw it with my own eyes, she says. With his things, his shoes and books. The fan turns lazily above her. But we fled from the old house like refugees, she says. We didn't take it. There was a cupboard under the stairs opposite your father's study. You remember? The cupboard without a handle. You couldn't see it. You had to feel for the edge and push. It was there. His father's study had a key in the outside lock. The door handle didn't turn, so you had to open it with the key. A wall of books faced you when you entered. A broad desk overlooked the driveway, and on the desk there were framed photographs of his father with foreign dignitaries, Yasser Arafat, Idi Amin, Princess Diana. Amir passes the stall a few times a day that week, and if there's no customer there, he stops. He calls for tea, and he and the boy sip it together. They don't quite look at each other, instead cocking their heads toward the car horns and the fruit sellers calling and the birds cawing and circling overhead and the tune the ice gola cart plays. One morning, Amir hears shouting on the street. An older man is arguing with the shoeboy in Pashto. Amir positions himself at the vegetable stall nearby and selects some aubergines, feeling them as though that could tell him something. The boy clenches and unclenches his hands at the hem of his kurta. People stop to watch. "Whatever he's done, forgive him," a legless beggar on a wheeled sled says as he pours himself into the shade. The man shouts a question at the boy. The boy doesn't answer, and the man takes off a sandal and slaps the boy across the face with it. Then he climbs onto a motorbike and rides away. Amir pauses at the boy's stall with his bags of groceries. "I could kill him," the boy says. "My uncle." He gestures that Amir should sit, then busies himself with a box of tools at the back of his stall. He turns suddenly. "I sold your shoes," he says. "Your father's shoes." "Someone offered 2,000. I didn't say yes. I didn't say no. I said, I will check. But he gave a deposit." He removes a folded 1,000-rupee note from his chest pocket. "It's a good price," Amir says, looking at the palms of his hands. "You should have heard me," I said. "These shoes, these are the best shoes, made from the finest skin. Skin like a baby. To wear these shoes is to wear a glove made of skin. He wanted them just like that." I said, "Come back in the afternoon." A rickshaw engine fires like a gun and startles crows from a thickly flowering gulmohar tree. "I thought you'd be happy," he says. "It's good," Amir says. "Well done. Commission for you." The boy takes a pair of burgundy sandals from the pile behind him and wipes them with the cloth. "I can't sell them," Amir says. "They're my father's shoes." The boy nods. He fishes a green plastic bag out from under his crate. "Oh," he says. He takes one of Amir's father's loafers out. "See." He angles it toward Amir. On the inside, there's the faint imprint of a foot. "What did I say? Narrow. Arched. The foot of a king. And the toes, see?" "A king," Amir says. "I'll tell you," the boy says. He instructs Amir to take off his shoes. He props one of Amir's feet in his lap and peels off his sock. "Nylon," he says, and holds it up to the light. He runs his thumb along the arch of Amir's foot and the calloused outside edge. "A lot of tension today," the boy says. He rubs a nub of bone that protrudes from the side of Amir's toe. "You do too much for people," he says. "But see, you could never wear these." He puts Amir's father's shoe beside Amir's foot to show him. "Okay," Amir says, and pulls his foot away. The salty sea breeze stings his eyes. "Listen to the foot," the boy says. "The foot says go forward, go back, stand still. If you listen, you'll know." Amir leaves the vegetables upstairs with the ayah and goes to Auntie Park for a walk. On his way back, he picks up a pound cake from Primetime for his mother. She is tapping the arms of her chair when the ayah wheels her in for tea that afternoon. "I didn't sleep at all," she says. "I remembered something." She pauses. "Why are you in the dark?" The ayah draws the curtains. Light filters into the room, through the jacaranda outside, the vent of the air conditioner that overhangs the balcony, and the shutters that aren't quite pressed to the wall. "How could they say he gave it away?" she says. "Your father promised me the house. He would give it to a stranger sooner than his brother." She takes a wedge of cake between her fingers. "And for that bastard to throw us out like common servants." She bites it in half emphatically, then finishes it. "Your father would have kept a record. Written it down." The ayah switches the overhead fan on. It buzzes but doesn't turn. "He wouldn't want us living like this, waiting for my brother to send another check." "They haven't fixed it," Amir tells the ayah. "Are you listening? This will show everything, that the house is ours." She reaches across and shakes him. "What are you talking about?" Amir says. "It's all done. It's finished." Ayah thinks it will be in the trunk. He wrote and wrote, lists and lists. It could be there. "You remember you were asking?" She claps her hands and the rings on her fingers clack like castanets. "The trunk is gone," he says. "Where is it?" "We didn't take it," the ayah says. "It could only be there." "Where? At the house? There's nothing there." "Everything is there," his mother says. "What did we take?" "The clothes on our backs. And then they wouldn't let us in. To our own house. Of course it's there." "We took everything that wasn't fixed to the floor," he says. "Why didn't we take that?" "We didn't," his mother says. "Maybe we didn't see it." "She knows." His mother nods at the ayah. "Then let her look," Amir says. "Amir," his mother says, "how can she with her kidneys?" "It makes no difference. You're losing track of time. It's all decided. It was decided long ago." "You tell them," she says. "You never tell people. They know us. The Chief Justice was at my wedding." She taps a pearly nail against the rim of her cup. "Did your father write?" she says. "Or was that my brother Ricky? Breaks my heart that Ricky died alone. Be thankful you have no siblings to see them die like that." Amir walks up the stairs to the top of the building. The uppermost flight ends at the roof, and he hunches there on the steps with his chin on his fist and the ceiling against his head. Death is an opening door, he thinks. He remembers his father's body wrapped in white gauze, balls of cotton wool in his nostrils and ears, and strangers crowding around him, carrying him away. He climbs down and finds his shoe seller on the street outside. "Sell them," Amir says, "and I'll take you for mithai." "Habshi halva," the boy says, laughing. "And barfi," Amir says, "and rasmalai, and laddus." At sunset, he waits in his car for the boy to pack up the stall. The wires at the cut end of the cable spark and twitch. They drive to Boat Basin. When the car is in second gear, his hand rests against the boy's knee. They eat mithai in the car with the windows rolled down, waving away flies and a beggar woman in a burqa. "Won't you give me dinner at least?" the boy says afterward, licking yellow laddu crumbs from his downy moustache. Amir drives to Seaview, and then along the road that curves sharply with the beach. For a stretch of several miles, the road is lit only by their headlights and the thin beams from motorcycles that rattle past. "Someone was shot here," he tells the boy. "Shooting is the sound of Karachi," the boy says. He makes a noise like a gunshot, and then another. "They were on a bike," Amir says. "Two of them. And their friend was with his mother in a car. They leaned in and shot him in the head. Not the mother. She tried to help, but what could she do?" The lights of the restaurants along the bay in Dodaria flash in the distance, and Amir speeds up. "I'll tell you something," the boy says. "That man before? I call him my uncle, but he isn't." He fogs the window with his breath. "I have enough uncles here." They pass between breeze block roadblocks and come around the bend to where restaurants are lined up closely against one another. A crowd is milling purposefully outside Kolachi, and cars are triple parked. Amir chooses somewhere farther along the row, almost at the end. They climb up steps that are slabs of stone and emerge onto a small gravel patch with a thatched roof on bamboo pillars. A neon light between the pillars buzzes. There are white plastic chairs and small round tables, and in the corner a broad chest freezer. They choose a couple of chairs where the patch ends at a steep rock face and the sea. The boy orders an ice cream soda and Amir orders another. Lights are pinned to the rocks below, and the sea is lit in shafts of lurid green that sparkle with moths and drifting plastic bags. They watch for fish. A wooden boat bobs past. The boy drags another chair toward him. "The foot says stay," he says, and slips his feet out of his sandals and rests them on the chair. A dark shape looms to one side of the horizon, and Amir thinks it must be the mangroves. "You could see the sea from the old house," he says. He hangs his arm over the edge of his seat, and his fingers knock against the boy's fingers like dice. He taps his nails against the boy's nails. The collar of the boy's kurta gapes. Light hair is scattered across his chest. "My father was always walking," Amir says. "Walking and looking, but not looking at something. Looking and thinking. He did things for other people all the time. There were people in a line at the door every morning with things for him to do. It wasn't his fault. He was always somewhere else, but also just here." The boy shifts in his seat. "With a man like that, such a man, there's no point in trying to be him, just to learn." "My mother did things," the boy says. "She took the ox out to the field and gathered alfalfa and sowed seed. She put mud on the walls and dung in the fire. She planted trees. The land wasn't ours, but it was like it was ours. The sweetest apples you ever had." He smacks his tongue against the roof of his mouth. Amir hooks his finger into the sleeve of the boy's kurta and pulls his hand nearer. The moon is low and red over the sea, and thunder rumbles in the distance. "People want me to go backward," Amir says. "But it's like digging up my father. I can't do it." He stands up, wobbles, and grabs the boy's wrist to pull him up. "All I want to do is go round and round," and he spins the boy and laughs. They drive back along Seaview. People throng outside McDonald's and the Cineplex, and cars queue to park in the shopping mall. Amr slows the car outside a high wall on a quiet, broad street, lit dimly by wrought iron lamps. A name and telephone number are painted on the wall. "I know it isn't here," he says. "I know it. So why do I feel like it is?" He looks hard at the boy and stops the car. He gets out, and he and the boy stand facing the wall. He puts his hands on it. "What is it?" "Nothing. But I can't be here. I can't look at it." "It was your house?" the boy asks. Amir nods. "Quite a big house," the boy says. "And inside, you can't see from here. There are trees and trees. Pepper trees, almond trees, and then the house. An old house. The station master's from British times." Here and there, bricks jut out at angles from the wall. Amr steps up on one and then another until his chin reaches the top. "See," he says. There are lights in the garden, and the house pulses golden at the center of a small forest of trees. It has a shingled roof and a columned portico. "This was a lawn," he says. "The best in Karachi. Dhaka grass." The boy glances over his shoulder, then kicks off his sandals and clambers up to the top of the wall, then slips softly over. "There's a chowkidar," Amr says. He hops down. He hears scrabbling from the other side. "I can't come back," the boy says. "There's nothing to hold." "There must be something," Amr says. He climbs up again, losing his shoes which clatter to the pavement. He swivels onto the top of the wall and reaches over to the boy. The tips of their fingers touch. Then he finds himself tumbling over the wall and onto the lush grass on the other side. He looks around to orient himself. The driveway is overgrown and strewn with split black jamuns. The light of a TV flickers from the chowkidar's hut by the gate. The hut has an opening, and a pair of crossed feet are propped in it. "We put tables here for parties," Amr says, and pulls the boy along the upward sloping lawn. "And a bandstand in the corner, and lights in the trees." They reach the portico. "These steps are worn," he rubs his foot along one, "from people running in and out." The front door is padlocked, and a peeling notice is taped to it. "If there is anything inside," Amr says, "we'll take it." He tries a window, and then another, and then a third, which rattles open and they duck through. A thick layer of soft dust covers the floor. The back wall of the house is a heap of bricks and rubble on the ground, and the moon hangs in a corner like a lantern, casting a silvery pink sheen over everything. Weeds and hedges and slender tree trunks frame the edges of the house. A digger is poised at a distance, with its shovel suspended. The first floor has crumbled away to the walls. The staircase ends a few steps up and then begins again, hanging from the ceiling by its banisters. Amir's knees shake and he thinks he will fall. The boy puts his hand on Amir's shoulder. "Friend," he says. "It was a big house." Birds rustle and flap in the rafters. "It was," Amr says. He turns his palms up. He looks at them, and they are broad like his father's. He takes a step forward. "This," he reaches to the left, "was a guest suite, and here," he indicates the right, "was my father's study. The handle only worked from the inside. I don't know why. And there was a table," he spreads his arms wide, "with pictures of my father with people. He had a sofa here," he turns. "And here was a hall with the drawing room on this side. The windows opened onto the garden. Here the dining room. The boy watches him. There was a swinging door to the kitchen, and then you came around again to the pantry where my mother made toast and tea and packet soup. This was a courtyard. These pillars went all the way around. You can see that the ground is lower here. There was a fountain, and the stairs went up to my father's bedroom. He points above him. My mother's was here, and mine between the two. He walks the perimeter of the building, trailing his hand along the boundary wall. He remembers music playing from the lawn, hearing it as he lay in bed upstairs, and laughter and glasses clinking, and someone shouting for ice, plenty of ice. We had peacocks, he says, returning to the boy. People say they're bad luck. They make a terrible noise. Silvery light is in the boy's hair, along the inside of his collar, on the tips of his fingers. Footsteps glow in the thick dust. Footsteps facing forward and backward, turning in concentric circles around them, as though they were a crowd of people. Armor steps nearer. A miner calls from the garden, and another answers. He steps closer again, until his toes are over the boy's toes. He leans in toward the boy's lips. Their eyelashes brush. The boy slips his arm between them and pushes Amir. Uncle, he says. The foot says stay, Amir says, and bears his weight down. I'm not well, his mother tells him in the morning, and her teacup trembles in her hand. The fan whips around. The power, he says. They fixed the cables. I'm full of rage, his mother says. I don't know why. I went to the house. What happened to it? She says. Then she looks around. Why are we here? Whose apartment is this? He waits, but her expression doesn't change. It's ours, he says. You know. This is all you talk about. She shakes her head. I don't. After Daddy, they said the house wasn't ours, that he'd given it to Cha-Cha. We filed the cases. You had to sign the papers, every page, one after the other. What have I done these 7 years but come and go from there? Hearing, 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 but no one to listen. Yes, she says slowly. Weren't we happy there? Take me out, she tells the ayah, replacing her cup on its saucer. The ayah wheels her to the doors that open onto the balcony and over the threshold. They say the city's changed. I haven't seen it. Your father and I ran away from that house. I couldn't have been a day over 15. There was a little gate at the back, and he met me there one night in his car with the engine running. It was so dark, I thought it was empty. You're thinking of somewhere else, Amir says, following her onto the balcony, resting his hand lightly on her shoulder. Below, there is no sign of the stall. A digger has returned to the plot opposite their apartment. Its shovel rings against the stony earth.
That was Taimur Sumro reading his story, Philosophy of the Foot. This is his first fiction publication. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, Orhan Pamuk reads Ibn Hakan al-Bukhari, Dead in His Labyrinth, by Jorge Luis Borges. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice in Apple Podcasts on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.